I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In the current issue of Rolling Stone magazine, Matt Taibbi writes this: if some overzealous patrolman chokes a guy all the way to death on video in a six-on-one broad daylight situation for selling a cigarette, forget about a conviction. Someone at least has to go to trial. You can't send hundreds of thousands of people to court every year on broken taillight type misdemeanors and expect people to sit still while yet another coroner declared homicide goes unindicted. It just won't hold if the law isn't the same everywhere. It's not legitimate. And in these neighborhoods, what we have doesn't come close to looking like one single set of laws anymore. Matt Taibbi is the author of the piece in the Rolling Stone titled "The Police in America Are Becoming Illegitimate: The Crooked Math That's Going to Crash American Law Enforcement If Policies Aren't Changed." He's also the author of The Divide. He spent 3 years working on that book and, as he says, spent a lot of time with people like Eric Garner. He's also author of Griftopia and The Great Derangement and a number of other books, and we're delighted to have him with us this hour. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I anticipate we'll have more than a few on this issue. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Matt Taibbi, thank you very much for being with us. Hello.
Thank you for having me on.
Hello. Yeah, our pleasure. You write, and I hadn't heard this part of the tape, that you can, on the tape, Eric Garner's tape, you can actually hear the echo of his years of experience, you write, with broken windows-style policing. What did you hear that was evidence of his years of experience?
Well, what he says is, every time you all see me, you mess with me, and this stops today. I think that's the exact quote. And what he means by that is what a lot of people in certain kinds of neighborhoods experience, which is that every time they're on their way home or they're standing on the wrong place in the street corner, you know, police come up and accost them. And it's not always an aggressive confrontation. It's not always an arrest. It's not always something that would be described as abusive, but it's always something. And I think that's what you hear in this tape is this is a person who admittedly does have, you know, a record of petty criminal offenses, but he's just expressing his frustration with being stopped so many times.
And what is the policy? Is it described as a broken windows policy in major inner cities in this country, a style of policing that's omnipresent?
Yeah, they call it by different names. In New York, it's famous for being, you know, known as the broken windows theory of policing. In other places, they call it hotspot policing. Other places, we'll talk about quality of life policing.
Mm-hmm.
And the concept is more or less the same in most major American inner cities now. The idea, and it was pioneered back in the early 90s, especially in the first Rudy Giuliani administration, the idea is that you pick up everybody on the street that you see committing even the smallest offense. So in the old New York, for instance, people would jump turnstiles right in front of New York City police officers, and cops wouldn't do anything about it because they had other things to worry about, or you know, you could see somebody maybe smoking a joint in an alley, and police would be worrying about something more serious, and they wouldn't stop that person. Now, every minor thing that you do, and that might include, you know, a petty piece of vandalism, you know, jumping a turnstile, riding a bicycle the wrong way down a sidewalk, carrying an open container of alcohol, they stop people for everything, and the idea is to get people who are carrying weapons or who have outstanding warrants, in other words, who are fugitives. And what they're supposed to do is throw away the people who didn't commit serious offenses, sort of throw them back. But what in practice they end up doing is it's this regime of writing hundreds of thousands of tickets for these minor misdemeanors, And they encounter very serious criminals in only a very small percentage of cases.
Mm-hmm. You, for your book, The Divide, spend, as you say, quite a bit of time, a number of years probably, at this shabby little courthouse at 346 Broadway in Lower Manhattan. Tell me more. You mentioned just now some of the cases you saw, but you were looking at fines that were given to people who obviously don't have very much money, who had to pay babysitters for, one of them was for drinking wine on her porch and
right.
obstruction when streets were completely empty of pedestrians. What did you see in that courthouse, and what kinds of fines did people have to pay, Matt?
Yeah, so I got onto this by I was actually researching a different story, and I was visiting a lawyer, and while I was in his office, I ended up sitting next to a guy, a 35-year-old African-American bus driver named Andrew Brown, who explained to me that he had been arrested for obstructing pedestrian traffic. And, you know, like a lot of, you know, white urban professionals in New York, I just didn't know what that was. And he showed me the summons, and sure enough, he'd been written up for that offense. And the way he described it was he was on his way back from a shift driving a bus. He stops in front of his project apartment building at 1 a.m., and he met a friend. They were listening to music on headphones, and the police stopped them. They thought their presence there was suspicious. They stopped them. They asked them for ID. They patted them down, and when they didn't get them for something more serious, they gave them both tickets for obstructing pedestrian traffic, which is, you know, it's absurd on its face, but it's even more ridiculous considering that it was 1 a.m. and there was literally nobody else on the street. So this turns out to be a relatively common practice. Obstructing pedestrian traffic is part of the disorderly conduct statute here in New York.
Mm-hmm.
You can give somebody a fine or a misdemeanor arrest for it. He ended up being taken to the station. He got searched. He spent a night in a station. Then he had to go to court, and I went to court with him. And there's this whole legion of people who have to deal with these summonses, and every single day, and it's all stuff like that. It's all, you know, public urination, obstructing pedestrian traffic, and the fines turn out to be like $100, $200, which doesn't sound like a lot to you and me, but the reality is it starts to add up after a while, especially if you're not really guilty of anything. In my guy's case, his own lawyer was telling him to plead because he just didn't understand why anyone would bother to contest that kind of offense when the amount of money was so small. But he did contest it, and they ended up getting police on the stand who admitted there were no other pedestrians on the street, and the judge did dismiss it. But that was a rarity. In reality, these things happen all the time. There are hundreds of thousands of these kinds of incidents in cities like New York every year.
Mm-hmm. And because you're so well known for guiding those of us who may not know a whole lot about money and the workings of Wall Street, your books and your writing have really given us details on corruption in Wall Street. I found it interesting you talk about that, too, and make a comparison. This is a pretty dramatic thing. If Eric Garner had been selling naked credit default swaps instead of cigarettes, you say the police, by virtue of a federal law called the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, would have been barred from even approaching him.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So way back in the end of the Clinton administration, one of the last things that his administration did before George Bush took office is they passed something called the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, which basically made it illegal to regulate derivatives of any kind. Without getting into what that is, it can entail a whole range of financial instruments, swaps, collateralized debt obligations. The thing that I mentioned, a naked credit default swap, is actually a kind of insurance policy where you're betting, two non-interested parties can bet on whether a third party makes his payments on a debt instrument.
Goodness gracious.
So it's actually so much like gambling that the law had to explicitly say that state gaming laws do not apply to these instruments. So if Garner had been, I mean, there's the point I was making is there's all kinds of crazy shady financial instruments that that authorities literally cannot even ask you about. Whereas if you're on the street and you're doing the smallest of financial hustles, which is taking a single cigarette out of a pack and selling it to passersby, you can be surrounded by six police officers, which is it's a huge difference in the way we treat people.
Yeah, and as far as I know, maybe I'm wrong about this. Nobody has gone to jail for the huge collapse of our economy that took place in 2008 and lost a whole lot of people, a whole lot of money.
No, we haven't had a single conviction of any, even mid-ranking executive for any of the frauds that led to the financial crisis. We're now 6 years out after the fact. According to many estimates, we're talking about at least hundreds of thousands of cases of fraud that went unpunished. And to this day, we've only had two serious criminal indictments. They both resulted in acquittals. So there's nobody doing even a day in jail for any of that stuff. The only people who've gone to jail from Wall Street are going for crimes that are unrelated to the crisis, things like Bernie Madoff and his Ponzi scheme, or insider trading, the Raj Rajaratnam case. But there's a whole world of criminality that basically goes unpoliced, and that was the point I was trying to make in that piece.
So why is it that nobody is going to trial in the Eric Garner case?
Well, we don't know yet exactly, because what happened in the grand jury hasn't become public yet. I think one of the things that most prosecutors will tell you is that if prosecutors want an indictment, they can pretty much get one. And so despite the fact that it was a grand jury that decided not to indict, what that really tells you, or at least that what happens in most cases, that the indication here is that the local authorities didn't really put their back into preparing a case against this officer in Staten Island, and which is the same thing you might say about the incident involving Michael Brown and Ferguson. Clearly, the prosecutors were not terribly interested in getting an indictment in that case. So I think the likelihood is that it's too politically sensitive to prosecute a police officer. It has to be something, you would think that this is a case that was just unequivocal. I mean, it's on video. There's no disputing the facts. Clearly, there was excessive force. A coroner ruled it an unnatural death, right, which means somebody had to be responsible. So, I don't know. I mean, there's no explanation for it, and that's why I think you're seeing so many protests.
So, obviously, we've seen protests, and they're continuing all over the country, Ferguson and then Eric Garner. And you sort of summarize what the future could be here in the title of your article, that this could, if we're seeing the police as illegitimate, many people are in this country, it's going to crash American law enforcement. I mean, what's ahead could be extremely difficult for this country and for safety in communities, really.
Yes, and I think important thing to realize is that this isn't necessarily the fault of police officers. I mean, I talked to a lot of officers for my last book, and a lot of them had the same dissatisfaction with these kinds of policing policies that the protesters are experiencing. They don't want to be out there busting people for riding bicycles the wrong way down a sidewalk. They don't want to be out there taking people to jail and strip searching them for littering. I mean, that's not what a person goes into law enforcement to do. They go into law enforcement because they want to protect people from dangerous criminals. And so there's a lot of dissatisfaction with this numbers game, this statistics-based policing. And when the public stops believing that these kinds of policies are legitimate, they're going to stop obeying police officers when they order them to drop their weapons or to move from one spot to another, and that's going to result in more and more difficult incidents.
We will, I'm sure, hear as soon as we go to phone calls, because as we've discussed these issues of policing, we've heard this before, and you mentioned somebody from one of the New York papers with a predictable response. Well, if Eric Garner had just done what the police told him to do, that's what we have to do. We have to obey completely when we're told what to do by the police.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, sure, right? I mean, that's what most people think. But the reality is, if you've already been stopped 40 or 50 times by the police for nonsense, and you've had a lot of unpleasant incidents leading up to that moment, at some point you're not going to just quietly submit when a police officer tells you that you have to go down to the station for selling a cigarette. I interviewed somebody who was just standing on a street corner. The police asked him to disperse. He wasn't quick enough to comply. They threw him in the back of a squad car. They bounced his head off the roof of the car. His $50 leather Yankee hat falls in a puddle, so he loses that. You know, it's incidents like this. People are going to stop. It's the anger that builds up over time before that incident. That's the question, not that incident.
Mm-hmm. And taking this to a political level for a moment before we go to phone calls, you sent a tweet recently talking about the nomination of Lynch to be Attorney General and also Eric Holder under huge pressure now with civil rights investigations. This has monster political implications in an election season. Talk more about that. How so?
Well, because the Democrats are in a terrible position going forward, because if they decide to bring a civil rights case against either Darren Wilson in Missouri or Joe Pantaleo, the police officer in Staten Island, then that's going to be a major reason that white middle American voters are going to turn out at the polls. We already saw this in the midterms. According to most political analysts, Ferguson had a major impact on the midterm outcomes. It turned white voters out to vote. And if they bring one of those cases and there's an Obama administration federal case against a local municipality that has already decided not to indict a police officer, that politically is going to be a very difficult thing for the Democrats to have to handle, and it's going to be used as fodder against whoever the candidate is. On the other hand, they should do it. So if they don't do it, they're morally doing the wrong thing, I think, and they're going to lose their base if they don't bring a case. So it's whether or not they start doing something about the Garner case, the Ferguson case, the Tamir Rice shooting in Cleveland, they're going to lose the enthusiasm that won Barack Obama the election in 08 and 12. That's going to vanish if they don't do something in these instances.
Matt Taibbi is our guest this hour, a terrific reporter. He's with Rolling Stone, and the piece that we're talking about is in the current issue. The police in America are becoming illegitimate, the crooked math that's going to crash American law enforcement if policies aren't changed. Matt's the author of a number of books. Griftopia was the last one we talked to him about. We haven't had a chance, I hope we will in the future, to discuss The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap, and he looks at what we're talking about here, picking people up for seemingly not very important infractions of the law when we are not looking at the people who are bringing down the economy, or people who, as he writes, are living on the east and west sides, upper east and west sides of New York, having their coke and weed safely home delivered with their Chinese food, while minorities in Bedford Stuyvesant and Harlem are catching real charges and jail time for the same thing. All right, our phones are all busy, so eventually there will be an opening for you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You can always send an email, that's talk@wpr.org, our Facebook page, where we'd love to have you continue the conversation with your messages, is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Matt Taibbi is with us this hour. A lot of response from you, so let's go to our phone calls. Sheree in Waupun is our first caller. Hi, Sheree.
Hi. You know, number one, it's an honor to talk to you, Kathleen, and especially to you, Matt. I am a big fan, just so you know. But I wanted to discuss, you know, how our black men are really treated from literally cradle to grave. And it's almost, you wouldn't believe it if you didn't see it. And the things that Matt spoke about are very true. Problem is, it starts even earlier. It starts with our black boys being suspended in school at a higher rate. It starts with them getting referred to the juvenile justice system a lot quicker. It also turns into an issue of recidivism, because once they're labeled and in the system, how can they get a job when they have these strikes against them? So it turns into a life of petty crime simply because of how they were tagged from the time that they were younger. And not to mention, you know, Matt is right when he says that we get arrested at a higher rate, because in Milwaukee alone, you know, someone who has marijuana, the difference of whether they'll be arrested is whether they're black or white. They're 8 times more likely to be arrested if they're black. You know, that's something that people don't understand, how it honestly, truly affects your ability to get a job when you're not given that second chance. And Matt is also right about the Democrats. I really feel like I don't have a home at this point. When Mr. Dixon made that the state of emergency, it was so disheartening to me, because I felt like my Democrat friends had just kind of left. I don't even know how to explain it. It's so frustrating to even discuss.
Sure, absolutely. You know, so thank you for the question. It's Sheree, right?
Yes.
Is that the name?
Mm-hmm.
I agree with all of that. I mean, I think it's got to be really disheartening. The Democratic Party has made a very, I think, a cynical calculation. I think they take minority votes for granted, and what they've been doing, and then I think they take a lot of different types of voters for granted, and they've decided to try to get away with certain things, and knowing that in the final analysis, black voters are going to turn out for them at the polls. They're not going to vote for Republicans. So it's better to, for instance, not bring a case, a civil rights case in the Ferguson incident or in the Staten Island incident, than it is to risk losing an independent voter who might have gone their way, a swing voter. Also, I think they take certain kinds of voters who are politically progressive for granted. So they decide not to prosecute high-level Wall Street executives because they're more concerned about getting funding from that community than they are about losing the vote of the person who might be upset about that. And about the other thing about interactions with the police at an early age, I'm obviously white, I can't speak to that for myself, but for my last book, I definitely talked to a lot of African-American men, particularly in New York, who all talked about the same thing, about how police officers were important figures in their lives as early as 7 and 8 years old, that it shaped their whole view of the government and society, their interactions with the police, and how they became more pointed and more aggressive after these sort of broken windows policies started to be implemented. You know, if you catch a marijuana charge, you're not going to get a student loan. I mean, there's all kinds of things that are going to set you back very seriously in this country, and that's what's behind a lot of the anger. And people don't get that. It's these little tiny interactions that turn into more serious things, life-altering incidents.
Thank you, Sheree, very much for your call. So what efforts are underway or do you think need to be underway? Obviously, some people must be thinking pretty seriously about the direction of policing, or police will be spending all their time policing demonstrations in this country.
Right.
So what will it take for there to be a serious review and some changes so these kinds of demonstrations and these kinds of deaths don't happen?
I don't know, because the problem here is political. I mean, it's the we've had a profound drop in the crime rate, the violent crime rate in this country, dating back 25 years now. It began back in 1990, 1991. Ever since then, we have consistently seen crime dropping all over the country, in the cities, out of the cities, everywhere. This is during a time when family incomes and real earning power has been dropping, so it's a counterintuitive thing. But over the same period of time, our prison population has more than doubled. Mm-hmm. So something very bizarre is going on in America, where we have significantly less a crime to prosecute, but we have more and more criminals all the time who are being put in jail. So it's clearly a political issue, and I think the reason for it is just that politicians who call for more people to go to jail are popular, and they're particularly popular with a certain kind of white suburban voter, and those voters tend to dominate elections. And until we can change that mentality, I don't see how there's going to be a change to it.
Jess in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This subject touches on a lot of different issues. One of them is the victimless crimes that you guys are talking about, where people get popped for seemingly minor or nothing offenses. It's really a revenue generator for the municipalities, the county, the state, whoever it might be, depending on who's giving the tickets. And it's a real annoyance for people who cannot afford it, whether it's lawyer or court costs and so on. Another issue, and this goes into our education system, is I have to let you guys know, there's organizations such as FlexYourRights.org, CopWatch, CopBlock. These are organizations that literally watch police, what they're doing with when they're holding a suspect or abusing that suspect in some cases. But there's no reason why a person should be in fear of their life because they have an encounter with a cop. If that person is handcuffed behind their back or in handcuffs and restrained, there's no reason they should be choked. It doesn't matter if the cop doesn't like what the person is saying or anything else. If the cop can't handle the stress of his job, get out of it. Period. It goes into another thing as well of jury nullification, but that's a little off topic. The sad fact is there's too many cops who are, you're claiming that they're good cops and they're frustrated and so on. How come they're not breaking the blue line and coming out en masse through their unions or wherever and saying, this is ridiculous, we didn't sign up to be police officers to do this kind of stuff? Mm.
Thank you, Jess, for your call. Well, Matt, you're hearing from a lot of those police officers, we didn't sign up for this.
Yeah, no, definitely. But, you know, he's also right that there aren't masses of them turning out and publicly protesting it. I mean, it's a tough thing because these policies do give police tools that they can use that are highly effective in, and I'm not endorsing them. I'm just telling you that with police officers, it's a whole lot easier for them to go after people if they can stop them for basically any reason and empty their pockets and ask for them for ID. It also, and this is in a hugely underrated or underappreciated part of this policy, it's a huge intelligence gathering operation also, because every one of these interactions ends up being logged by police and computerized, so they know who was hanging out with who at whatever day. And they have huge databases about who's people are in each neighborhood. It's not always unpopular with the police, unfortunately. And just to get back to an earlier part about the revenue generation portion of it, that is absolutely true. And that is something that a lot of police officers complain about, because I've had people tell me that their precinct captains told them that they had to empty a pad every month. And that clearly has a revenue goal behind it. There are also things that are kind of hidden costs that people don't understand. Like if you get arrested and charged with a crime, you have to have a DNA test taken for certain kinds of offenses, and you have to pay for that DNA test. And there's lots of little things like that end up coming out of your pocket once you get put into the system, and it does generate a lot of revenue for cities.
Mm. Jess, thanks very much for your call. Stassi in Illinois, hi.
Hi, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like to support our police. I would like to be very grateful for everything what they do. I feel very safe when they are around, And honestly, I don't understand why this case of Mr. Brown, how he became a hero, I don't understand at all. He was a criminal, and what happened, unfortunately, but you would expect this kind of... And it doesn't matter what if she was black or white or some other nationality. It absolutely doesn't matter. And if I need to be stopped by police, I will stop. I will do everything what they ask me to do, because I understand they try to make an order in our country. And I don't understand why it's racial case suddenly. There are many whites who were killed by police, and nobody talks about it. And actually, I think media does a huge disservice by not educating people. That you have to obey what police says, and that's it. It doesn't matter what you think. You have to do exactly what they do. And this is what you need to teach little kids. They don't know it. And if you talk about, if you try to criticize African Americans, you'll become racist right away. I also disagree with that. I am not a racist at all, but there are facts. Unfortunately, African Americans, bigger percentage in prison than whites, unfortunately. But this is a problem, but it's not a police problem.
Can I ask you a question? I'm sorry, what is your name again?
Stassi.
If you were stopped not one time, but let's say 50 times in a year, would your opinion change?
No, I would do still. I would do it 100 times. If I need to be stopped, I will stop. I will do exactly what they do, because I obey the law. You cannot break law.
So it wouldn't bother you to be stopped 50 times in a year for no reason at all?
For no reason at all. I was stopped. I'm not in this country, in different country, many times with no reason. And I understood it was very important. Police cannot read your mind, and they cannot read my mind. They don't know what I think. They don't know what I want to do.
Okay, well, I'll tell you, I lived overseas for 10 years. I lived in the former Soviet Union. I was routinely stopped by the police there because I was a foreigner and police were looking for a bribe, and they stopped me for anything and everything, and it was extremely frustrating. And I know that people who are stopped over and over and over again for extremely trivial offenses, there's no way that that's not aggravating. You may say that you're not going to get upset by it. You may say that you'll obey a police officer the first time, but the 50th time that you get stopped in a year, especially if you're 14 or 15 years old, you're going to start copying an attitude to the police. It's just going to happen, because that does not happen in my neighborhood. I'm in the same city in New York City. I've been living here for 15 years. I've never been stopped by a police officer, and yet I've talked to 18-year-old African-American men who've been stopped over 100 times in their lives already. So there's clearly a dichotomy. You'll do it, obviously, if the law is equal, but if it's not equal, you'll stop doing it. I just totally disagree with your position on that.
So what did you do in the Soviet Union when you were stopped all the time?
Well, I paid the bribe. I mean, that's
you did. You paid a bribe.
Yeah, of course.
Wow.
Yeah. But I mean, that's it's that kind of behavior. Police behavior is just as irritating and illegitimate, I think, as these stop and frisk type policies. They're the same kind of annoyance. We in this country, we consider it, you know, un-American to stop somebody for no reason at all, and yet that's what these policies do. That's the stated purpose of these policies, is to randomly check people for guns and warrants, and that's not right. They should have to have a reason. It should be a good reason.
We seem to have a problem in this country walking around in somebody else's shoes, because if you talk to African Americans, I mean, in Ferguson, for heaven's sake, they've been stopped. People who are reporters who live in that area have been stopped 40 times, 50 times for having snow on the license plate when it's snowing. I mean, you have to realize that there's an injustice here, that you have to listen to other people's reality and understand that it may not be exactly fair. We don't seem to be able to do that, many of us.
No, and I think, again, it's a perception problem that people have. You're exactly right. They can't they can't imagine what it's like to have to put up with it over and over and over again. And a lot of the stop and frisk stories I hear are, they all start out the same. The first time it happens, they're cool about it. You know, they go along with it. They let the police officer search their pockets, but the 10th time they start to get a little bit, you know, chippy. Yeah. And then, you know, I talked to one young man who got taken in and had to spend a night in jail for graffiti because a police officer found a highlighter in his pocket. Now, the graffiti on the wall was in black ink, and he's holding a pink highlighter. And this kid had to spend a night in jail for something he clearly didn't do just because the police officer didn't like the look of him. I mean, that stuff, it totally colors your attitude towards the police.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Michael on Facebook says, the belief in the legitimacy of police and elections are pillars that hold this country together. If those pillars lose credibility, things will get worse faster than most Americans can imagine. Fiat currency, law enforcement, and election results are things that depend more on the belief in their legitimacy and value than their actual value.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's true. And I think that's what... that's what, again, middle American voters don't realize about how serious these situations with Ferguson and now with Staten Island, how serious they are, because in certain communities there's a tipping point at which people will simply no longer consider the police legitimate and they will stop complying. And that's a political decision which will lead to, you know, very serious consequences for everybody when that happens.
Matt Taibbi is our guest this hour. His current piece in the Rolling Stone is The Police in America Are Becoming Illegitimate, the crooked math that's going to crash American law enforcement if policies aren't changed. Here's our phone number. A line is open if you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter @KDunnShow, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Matt Taibbi is our guest this hour. We go back to phone calls and Chukuma from Minnesota. Hi, Chukuma.
Hi. Three real quick things. One is, where on the officer's badge will they be placing the swastika or the black SS? The other one is, why are we not hearing from officers of color? Everybody who's talking about this is white. And the third thing, which I think is really important, is these people are not African Americans. They are Americans, African. They are Americans. This is happening to Americans. To call people of color African American is making them sound like they're foreigners.
Well, I think that that's a choice that many African Americans make, to call themselves that. Why don't you center on the officers of color? Has anybody talked? Is there a breakdown? Officers of color in minority communities acting differently? Is there more outrage among officers of color? Do you know?
I mean, not in my experience, but look, it's more of an issue when you have a minority community that's policed by a mostly white police department. And that, unfortunately, happens more often than you suspect. You know, partly because of the situation and because of the history with the police, there isn't as much incentive for young African-American men in particular to go become police officers. It's not something that'll, you know, is very popular. So you see a lot of cities that are like Ferguson where the numbers are all backwards. I mean, I forget what the actual demographics are there, but it's completely upside down. If I remember correctly, the population is something 75% non-white or something like that, and it's more or less the opposite in terms of how many white police officers there are on the force there. You know, I saw similar phenomena in different cities here in New Jersey that I've been to, in Bedford-Stuyvesant, a majority of the officers were white. And yes, I there are black officers associations in a lot of these cities, and I know that a lot of African American officers are deeply conflicted about the work that they do. I mean, I've talked to a few of them, but it's not at the point yet where there's going to be where they're going to be breaking off from the rest of the force. I think you know, it's a tough job to do if people feel that you're not fully on board with the team, and I don't think you're going to see that kind of an internal protest anytime soon.
Mm-hmm. And there's absolutely no, we've all been helped by the police, too. There's absolutely no doubt that this is one very hard job. I think about that all the time with the police, how hard it must be to be a police officer.
It's an incredibly difficult job. I mean, I spent a lot of time last year in Camden. I did a story about policing in Camden, New Jersey, which is one of the most crime-ridden cities in America. Incredibly difficult place. And what police officers have to go through on a daily basis is unbelievably stressful. You think about it, you know, you're dealing with people who are high on every drug under the sun. A substantial portion of them are sick with, you know, HIV and other diseases. You have to reach into pockets and you don't know if there are going to be needles in there. You know, you're dealing with people who are not rational, who are, you know, throwing up and bleeding in your car. You know, it's and then, you know, that's not even taking into consideration the gun violence threat. I mean, you know, police officers have to deal with a lot of stuff, and they are absolutely under stress, and it is totally reasonable to expect that in some cases they're going to overreact. But that just, you know, what happened with somebody like Eric Garner, you know, one of your previous callers pointed out, there's absolutely no reason why that situation had to get out of control. That's not the kind of situation. You know, if you're chasing someone down an alley and you don't know whether you're going to get shot, that's one thing. But if you've got six of you standing around a guy who isn't resisting, there's no reason to jump on him and choke him to death. That just doesn't need to happen.
Yeah. And then to have video of it so that we all, when we see it, everybody cringes. It's just hard to watch that. And then to have it just, something has to happen as a result of that action, because it's obviously wrong what happened to most everybody's eyes. This is wrong.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. They're doing themselves, I think, a disservice by not indicting in that case.
Yeah. Pat in Madison, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to comment. I think there's been a lot of negative information on this show, all directed at the police. But a couple of years ago, I was at a conference up in Green Lake, and there was a law enforcement conference. People were from all over the state. And one afternoon, there was this golf outing. And so these cops all jump on this bus to go to the golf outing. And 10 minutes after they leave the conference center, on a rural highway, a pickup truck blew a stop sign and went hit by a construction truck. And the pickup truck rolls and starts on fire. Every cop, I think there were like 16 of them on that bus, immediately got off that bus, broke the windows out because this truck started on fire, and pulled this kid who was driving the truck out of the burning truck before it really exploded. And then they did CPR and tried to keep him alive until ambulances got there. They got it back on the bus after that and went to the golf outing. Afterwards, they talked about it that evening, but no one got any kind of public publicity or compliments or thank yous from anyone. And so here is this terrible accident, and cops do this all the time. And you had to put yourself in danger to get near that truck. And they did it, and they did it without any hesitation. So by all the negative stuff that's going on right now, I think you're really dissuading people that might want to try law enforcement as a career. And I think you got to remember, this stuff goes on every day where they do really good things, and there is no public acknowledgement.
I understand that, but the consequences of the kind of behavior that we've been witnessing are far-reaching, and that it's not the purpose of this show to talk about how great police are. We've all had incidents, I think, where they've done wonderful things for us. But the consequences of having people not believe in policing because of some of what we've seen is worthy of our attention, don't you think, Pat? I mean,
of course, I think that's worthy of our attention, and I think it's a problem. But I don't think you should ignore the other part of the role that the police play, which, in my opinion, is everyday common stuff that they're doing that is good for people, and it gets no recognition. So,
Well, look, it looks, I think everybody recognizes that the police do a tremendous service to society, and they're just by nature of the job it's heroic. They're putting themselves out in the line. They're putting their lives in danger. I personally take the position that a lot of this isn't the fault of the police. I think it's kind of like an unjust war. This is a bad policy. We are allocating police resources in a certain way, and we're telling them to behave in a certain way in neighborhoods that does them a disservice, and gives them a bad reputation. And I think that a lot of police would like to go back to the old days where they just investigated crime and tried to catch criminals, as opposed to this throwing a net over the whole population and sifting through and seeing what they can find. I think that policy is really the issue. It's not are police good or bad.
Right.
Is the policing policy good or bad?
Doug on an email says, in 2005, the Supreme Court ruled that the police do not have a constitutional duty to protect someone. Their job is to enforce the law.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I think most police would, though, protect somebody. I mean,
and I think there was some question, focusing on Ferguson for a moment, as to what Missouri law was in terms of shooting to kill, that the law may be interpreted more broadly there. It might be a specific law there that if you feel as though your life is in danger and you're given incredible latitude here, that you're not at fault.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I couldn't speak to that. But I do know that what happened with Michael Brown, and it was very typical of the kinds of things that we're talking about in this program. I mean, the first thing that alerted police to Michael Brown was they felt that he was obstructing traffic. You know, it was that was the
right
instinct that led. I mean, yes, there was another incident earlier in the day, but they wouldn't have had the confrontation had it not been for this policy.
Yeah. Let's go to Ray in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. We're focusing on just the police. The police are one leg of this stool of injustice. Here in Milwaukee, we have aldermen and alderwomen who basically don't care what the police do. My alderman, Nick Kovac, when Dontre Hamilton was shot in the park, I called him maybe 10 times over the next 4 or 5 weeks, and just asked him to clarify the law to me so that I would know in the future if I wanted to take a nap in one of Milwaukee's city parks, is it now illegal? Nick Kovac can't even take the time out to call back and explain what the law is to the people who want to follow the law. So it's also the people who are supposed to be managing the police who are also, you know, letting them go wild. And by the way, we had a I can't breathe thing happen here in Milwaukee. I think it was River West. A young man was accused of armed robbery. Now, I don't know if he had a gun or what actually happened, but he died in the back of the police car, and his exact words were, "I cannot breathe."
Yeah, I mean, there have been a lot of these incidents now lately, and it seems like, especially with the way the internet is now, suddenly people are able to see, vividly all these things that are happening all over the country, and organizations like that Cop Watch that one of your other callers mentioned. I think that's one of the reasons why these protests are gaining as much traction as they are, is because people are able to see about these things and not just hear about them secondhand months later or read about them in news clippings. They're actually able to see them.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. We're out of time. So, Matt, thank you very, very much for the article.
Yeah,
and I hope we can do the book sometime. I haven't read it yet because I didn't know. Well, I would have if I'd known you were going to be with us today, but it wasn't about the book. But I wish we could do the book sometime in the future. That would be a good thing.
Of course, anytime.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you. Matt Taibbi, our guest, he's a fine investigative reporter and is taking on a lot of issues that not too many other people are. His latest piece is The Police in America Are Becoming Illegitimate, the crooked math that's going to crash American law enforcement if policies aren't changed. It is in the current issue of Rolling Stone magazine. And although we didn't talk about the book, he spent a lot of time looking at this justice divide in his latest book, which we'll book him for down the road, Divide: American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. The Korean War, Christmas time, hour two of our program.